Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is James Petras. Listeners don't need me to explain who Jim is. He's a regular on this program, always, always with vital comments to make about the big issues going on today. Jim, there is so much going on. Let me let you jump in where you wish to begin. We'll try to get as much in the program as possible.
Well, Steve, I first want to start off with the Ukraine, which you wrote an excellent article on. The fact of the matter is the Ukraine president, so-called Poroshenko, is in Ottawa, and then he's in Washington. He's got the begging cap out because the country's broke. The currency has fallen about 60% since the seizure of power in Kiev, and they're broke. They have huge debts. Their economy is sliding at a rate of minus 10% so far this year, and estimates are it's going down further. They've alienated half the country. They've engaged in a bloody military campaign to try to conquer the dissidents and the pro-democracy movements in eastern Ukraine. And yet the U.S. Congress stands and gives this thug a standing ovation as if he's some kind of messiah coming out of the shadows of a dictatorship, when in fact he's engaged in a violent overthrow of the government and is in the process of committing war crimes against his own people.
It really is shocking, Jim. I mean, this guy is a thug. He's an oligarch billionaire. He's a crook. He's a neoliberal. He's a confrontationalist. He's an imperial war maker. And yesterday he was in Ottawa, and I mean, they treated him like visiting royalty, Jim. And today he's in Washington. It's a little bit early. I don't think he's addressed the Congress yet. I guess it's later today. He'll address a joint session of Congress. Can you imagine a world-class thug being invited? Well, I can't imagine, Jim. It happens so often. But a world-class thug invited to Washington to address a joint session of Congress. I mean, they ought to put the cuffs on him and put him in prison.
Well, Steve, one glaring issue here is the fact that the bulk of his fighting forces, the most aggressive units, are Nazis, not neo-Nazis. They're Nazis. They wear Nazi insignias of war. They're military heroes, all fought with Hitler in World War II. They have been engaged in crimes against civilian populations, including in Odessa, where they burned alive 40 people who were escaping street mobs in a trade union building. This aspect of his government, the neo-Nazi, as they call them, but they're not neo, they're old-fashioned Nazis, engaged in warfare, and that they are the cutting edge of his military offensive. And yet no one wants to mention that. Not a single member of Congress stood up, has stood up, or will stand up and say, look, Mr. Poroshenko, why do you have Nazis in your government? Why do you have Nazis fighting your war? How do you expect the American people to bankroll a neo-Nazi military that is killing its own people? No, that doesn't take place in the U.S. Congress. They stand on their hind legs and cheer because the Russians have been demonized as aggressors, when in fact they are the greatest peacemakers and are trying to find a way to reconcile the irreconcilable.
Yeah, that's so true, Jim. I mean, literally, truth is turned on its head. Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, both of them, since conflict began, they've gone all out for peaceful conflict resolution. But the way the media reported and the way Western capitals reported, exactly the opposite. The big lies drown out the important truths that need to be told. And, of course, we have the terrible war without mercy that I think is just in an interregnum stage right now, because the freedom fighters, as I like to call them, in southeastern Ukraine really got the better of Ukraine's military. It really surprised me, Jim, that, military.
Steve, it's not surprising. When you're fighting on your home ground, when you're fighting an aggressor who's destroying your homes, killing your neighbors and your relatives, you have an incentive to fight and to fight to the bitter end, because you're really defending house, home, and family. Whereas the invaders, most of them are either ideologically driven fascists, or else they're conscripts who are there because they're told to be there. And who wants to die for a dictator, millionaire or billionaire in Kiev? So I think the motivations that are very important in any kind of defense is really the key here. And I think what you mentioned in your article, and I think is very important, this is a treaty that has no future, because the purpose of the treaty from the point of view of Poroshenko is essentially to gain time. They were losing the war. They were being driven out of the dominated, occupied areas. So they signed up an agreement because there was massive defections in order to stack up arms. And I say that because the United States has 1,500 troops now in NATO in Ukraine doing military exercise. The U.S. slams additional sanctions with the Europeans on Russia. Those are not moves toward deepening and prolonging a ceasefire. Those are preparations for a new round in the war. And I think what they're going to do is present the East with some phony paper promises of greater devolution of authority, bilingualism, but they're not worth the paper they're written on. As soon as they disarm the Eastern Ukraine freedom fighters, they will go in and impose a dictatorship. They will deny them everything they promised them. I guarantee you that. And so the only solution is partition. What's going on in the United Kingdom should take place also in Ukraine. A free vote and referendum on, you can put three choices down. You can put return to the status quo. You can put autonomy with the federal system, or you could put independence and let the people decide.
Well, absolutely, Jim. And I think you raised a very important point. On the one hand, the Ukrainian army had the upper hand for most of the conflict that began in early April. But into the conflict in more recent weeks, the freedom fighters, the self-defense forces in southeastern Ukraine, got the better of Ukraine's military. A key factor, which I mentioned a number of times in articles, was that the rank and file Ukrainian soldiers want no part of fighting their own citizens. They're underpaid, they're poorly fed, they're poorly treated. I mean, these kids just don't want to be there. They want to go home. A lot of them have simply laid down their arms, they've crossed the border into Russia for safe haven, or they've gone home, or just plain deserted, or whatever. Some of them have joined the ranks of the freedom fighters.
They were deceived fundamentally, because all of the leaders, so-called, that were imposed by the United States, and we were told by Victoria Nuland that the U.S. spent $5 billion in propping these types, they deceived their soldiers. They told them they were going to fight Russians, or pro-Russians. When they get there, they find that the people they're attacking are Ukrainians. They speak Ukraine, they live in Ukraine, and they're fighting for their own self-government. And so what a deception that is. Instead of seeing Russians coming down from Siberia, they're seeing steel workers who've doffed their picks and picked up a rifle. They've seen coal miners. They've seen all sorts of business people deciding to become patriots. And so the shock of recognition, hey, this is an invading Russian army. These are local Ukrainian people that speak the same language and look the same as we do. And I think that was one of the breaking points, the lies, deceptions, in addition to the hardships that you mentioned imposed. But I think it's, look, we're not fighting invading Russians. We're in fighting our own working people.
Yeah, true, Jim. And the flip side of the Ukrainian rank and file indifference and upset about being sent to fight their own citizens is the tremendous incentive of the people, the fighters in southeastern Ukraine, to fight for the democracy they want and deserve, and they really deserve universal support. So these people have every incentive of the world simply not to quit until they get the minimal demands that they absolutely deserve, and the Ukrainian military is the exact opposite. They just want to lay down their arms and go home. So that's what turned the tide. And the heavy weapons that the self-defense forces have gotten have been what the Syrian army simply left behind when they walked away. They left tanks, they left artillery, they left other weapons, and that's the ones that are using. These are the weapons that the big lies say Russia is supplying or Russian troops are there involved in the fighting, and of course none of that is true.
Yes, Steve, and now we should turn to this latest announcement by President Obama that the U.S. is intervening in the conflict in Iraq, but not with ground troops. It was such a blatant lie. Even the media, Financial Times, says the U.S. has 1,500 ground soldiers now engaged in all levels of the conflict, including on the front lines, supposedly advising. But when you're on the front lines, you're not only advising, you've got your finger on the trigger. And I think the U.S. is a creeping intervention. I mean, this isn't one big massive entry. It's going to be a few hundred each week, and it's going to be, well, first we have to advise, then we have to send troops to protect the advisors, and then we have to bring in troops to back up the people that are protecting the advisors. And before you know it, you go from 1,500 to 5,000 to 10,000, and the sky's the limit. Our forces are being threatened. They'll say our soldiers are being threatened. This is a kind of grand deception, because the overwhelming amount of U.S. people don't want a return to Iraq. They saw too many atrocities. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were murdered in cold blood by the U.S. occupation under Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and Obama. And that's caused some mental disturbances among the soldiers. You're going in shooting up civilians, and you come home, and you're no longer under the military exoneration, but your head is full of crimes, and that's why there's so much suicides and mental disorders in the United States now, because of the war. And here is Obama again re-entering the war. This is a war that should be decided by the Iraqis. And furthermore, if they're talking about a coalition, they should involve the countries that are most proximate, the president of Syria and the president of Iran. They should be part of a regional settlement here. Instead, the U.S. Intervenes, and lo and behold, according to the newspapers I'm reading today, the Financial Times, the number of jihadists has gone from 20,000 to 30,000 just in the period of 2 weeks that the U.S. has been bombing. So right away, the ISIS people have converted what was essentially a sectarian local war into a war against imperialism because of the added U.S. presence. So instead of lessening the power and attraction of the ISIS, we've vastly increased, 50% increase in active combatants. And this is just from the beginning. This is not going to be a limited war at all. And Kerry admits it. He says this is going to go on for an extended period of time. Sooner or later, the U.S. casualties will start to mount. whatever casualties have taken place already have been covered up.
Jim, this is the way the Vietnam War began, that, you know, with advisors and then a few forces and a little this and a little that. And the U.S. forces that are in Iraq, these aren't ordinary forces. Obama ordered 1,000 or 1,100 or so to begin with, then 475 more to follow. I mean, there could be limitless numbers to follow them. There could be brigades of combat troops. But the special forces are not ordinary soldiers. These are elite forces. They're trained killers. These people know how to fight. They know how to kill. They know how to do the worst kinds of things in wars, unlike the ordinary soldiers. They're in the ranks. They obey orders from their superiors. But the special forces have elite training to commit all kinds of belligerent acts. And these are the people that are in Iraq now. And the story, along with the Iraq story, Jim, is what Congress voted yesterday. But they voted to they didn't vote funding. They voted to give Obama approval to train and to arm rebel groups that are being sent into Jordan at the at an Arab American military encampment there to be trained to be sent back into Syria to fight the Syrian government. And
You know, Steve, these many of these people that are taking the training and arms and financing, when they go back, they're going to join ISIS. Because you think ISIS is sleeping. Most of the commanders and the military strategists are not religious fanatics. They are former Baathists. They are trained officers that worked under the Saddam Hussein government. And they, one of their strategies is to set up front groups of so-called moderates. And these people get training, they get arms, they get financing, and they channel it to ISIS. So the U.S. is preparing the cadres that will fight on behalf of ISIS. They're not fools. They know the U.S. would not support openly ISIS, but they will support a dummy group that is set up as a sort of a rebel group. But immediately we saw them signing agreements between ISIS and the moderates. So there isn't a clear break between the so-called moderates and ISIS. There's a continuum, and there is a flow going back and forth. That is, the ISIS penetrate these groups, and then they turn around and channel all the resources they get back to their home allegiances.
Well, Jim, this is longstanding U.S. policy, just the way the Reagan administration supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviets in the 1980s. They're today's Taliban, and America supports al-Qaeda, uses al-Qaeda both as an enemy and an ally, and the same thing with these extremist fighters. They call themselves the Islamic State. I use three names in my articles at times, but they call themselves the Islamic State. And, I mean, there you are. Washington uses them as both allies and enemies, and their fighters are being trained in Jordan at this operation, this Arab America Operational Command Center that's going on, and again, shipped into Syria to fight the Syrian forces. I don't know what the devil U.S. forces are doing in Iraq. I mean, certainly an air campaign can't destroy any kind of an effective group, and whatever numbers of fighters they have, I don't know how anybody can measure them exactly, whether it's 20,000, 30,000. My God, it could be 50,000. Jim, and they seem to be having an easy time getting lots of people to want to join them from various countries, including Western countries, including America, European countries. So they literally have thousands of fighters, and the Syrian Iraqi border is very porous, so they can move back and forth very, very freely, and they control big chunks of territory in both countries. But there's no way this thing is going to end easily or quickly, Jim. I mean, we could be on here 10 years from now, and this thing could be going on.
Yes, with casualties and enormous costs.
Oh, indeed.
At a moment when they're threatening to reduce pensions in Illinois and cut off pensions in Michigan, they're pouring billions into this failed projects, military engagements in Iraq and Syria and wherever else. There's a direct relationship between the growing militarized imperialism abroad and the domestic decay of public services and public employment. There is a direct correlation. So if teachers are getting cuts in Chicago, they can thank the increasing expenditures for military contractors in Iraq.
Oh, they sure can. I mean, such a large percentage of America's budget goes for belligerence in different forms, war making, including war making on the homeland. Department of Homeland Security, I remember I called it in articles years ago, America's Gestapo, and it really is in all its in all of its activities, including a waging war on Latino immigrants. But the horrors that go on at home and abroad, Jim, and this is the way America uses its resources, not for homeland needs that really need terrible attention, and of course popular needs. They're getting eroded in plain sight. I mean, they're literally heading en route to disappearing altogether. And this is Obama's agenda. A Democrat, my God, I mean, I can't imagine that Mitt Romney had he won the election would have done worse than Obama. I mean, Obama literally is as warrior a U.S. president as I can remember, and it just gets worse and worse. So with all the wars going on now, including America's no intention of getting out of Afghanistan, withdraw a lot of the troops, but leave 10 to 20,000, maintain control over the country, the Iraq situation heating up toward a full-blown war, the Syrian situation heading toward it's Obama's proxy war, heading for direct U.S. involvement with U.S. bombing, and I think a statement out of the White House, forget who made it, but a statement said that if U.S. warplanes come over Syria and bomb Syrian territory and Syria intervenes against them, this will give Obama just cause to literally go all out to state openly that he is waging all-out war against Syria. He will attack the Syrian defense forces who contest American warplanes coming in to bomb their own country. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, Jim.
No. Steve, we have a last few minutes. I think we should talk about the election today in Scotland that has enormous consequences. I think the first thing I want to say about this is that the Scott people have every right to vote for independence, and I think it would be beneficial. Let's not forget that during the 80s, the British government that went for banks and financial interests under Thatcher closed down the major coal mines, the major steel mills, the major shipyards, the port activities, and had enormous damage on the Scott economy. The Scots still have free higher education. They are very much in favor of public health programs that they have, National Health Service. The British government is looking toward, first of all, it's introduced tuition, a vast increase in tuition. They also are privatizing the National Health Service. They did enormous damage. So the people are voting in Scotland, not just out of pride in Robert Burns's poetry. They're voting because they're fearful of this kind of pro-capitalist, anti-welfare agenda that's facing them, both from the Labour Party and Conservatives and Liberals. The other thing I want to say about this vote is that they talk about a free and independent vote, but every single media of any substance is against them, they've been running full-page editorials against them, threatening. They've mobilized all the banks and big businesses to threaten to leave Scotland. It's a terror campaign. This isn't a free election. I admire the Scott people, the 50% or so who are going to vote for independence in the face of media terror, business terror, and political terror. It's a terror campaign because they're not providing reasonable discussions of what the economic grievances are. Instead, they're just threats. And this is really tells you the limits of capitalist democracies when they can lose to a popular, conscious electorate. They turn on the terror tactics.
Well, that's exactly right, Jim. It really shocking. Of course, the BBC is right in the middle of this, owned and operated by the British
protested.
Government.
You know, there was 100,000 people in the streets, and a good percentage of them marched to the BBC and said, stop propagandizing against us.
Oh,
we
didn't
pay
know that.
Taxes to finance you, and all you're speaking for is for London, not for Glasgow.
Jim, I think in my mind it'll be an earthquake if the yes vote wins, because in a close vote it would be so easy for Britain to rig the for Britain to manipulate things, their allies in along with their allies in Scotland, manipulate the vote just enough to make the no votes come out ahead. But if the polls are right, it's extremely close. The last I saw were three polls that favored the no votes and one that favored the yes votes, but that was some days ago, so I don't know where it stands today. But I believe 10% of Scottish voters are undecided, so that's the big variable. It depends on the way they go. But if it's that close, you can easily manipulate things to come out the way the British government wants it to, and that's what I fear is exactly going to happen. If it comes out the opposite way to that, Jim, in my mind, it'll be an earthquake.
Well, I think it's a sign of our times, as people cannot engage in this feudal enterprise within state parameters, which are rigged. So people want a government that's smaller and closer to them. That's why there's referendums pending in Spain, in Belgium, and even in Italy now, because these central governments are imposing these austerity programs and privatizations and slash-and-burn policies. People want to have a government which is more responsive to their interests, and perhaps federalism in the Ukraine, federalism in the sense of a new state is what's on the agenda.
That's exactly right, Jim. Ordinary people, millions of ordinary people, they simply want the rights they deserve. And when they live under a government that denies them those things, they have every right to resist and demand something much better. And that's what the Scottish vote is all about. And, of course, yeah, again, Spain and Catalonia, Italy, I guess, and Venice. I don't know if any other areas are involved. Italy, I think, refuses to hold a referendum. We'll have to watch that and see what happens. But this could really spark some things in other parts of the Western world. Especially, it would be wonderful. I'd love to see the state of Illinois secede from America, Jim.
Well, it's not probably likely, because the Chicago Cubs are part of a national league, and so probably you would have a split ballot there.
And we don't exactly have the best government in Illinois. I don't think in New York either, Jim. I don't know whether any state has the kind of government that I would really want to live under. But it would be very interesting if a couple of the states in America decided they wanted no more part of America's agenda. I mean, just to get out from under the belligerence, the foreign wars, the imperial wars, they're using budgets for death and destruction instead of basic needs. I mean, this would be wonderful.
Well, I think things are polarizing, Steve. In Sweden, the extreme right, the neo-Nazis, got 13% of the vote, which means one out of every nine Swedes voted for neo-Nazis. And the left did okay. They defeated the center-right parties, but they didn't create a majority. So on the one hand, we're glad that the incumbent neoliberal regime lost. We're glad that the socialists and social democrats won, but still, in relation to that, we also got the rise of the neo-Nazis. So we're getting a more polarized population. People that say no to liberal capitalism from the left and from the extreme right. And I don't know if this is a pattern that we're going to be seeing in the future elsewhere.
Oh, indeed, Jim. Sweden, many, many years ago, used to be a very socially minded country. It certainly is not now. And with the neo-Nazis in Sweden, I think it's an immigration issue. But you get one issue, and it just morphs to other issues. I mean, they want their own hardline agenda. It's really terrible. The Swedish people, the Scandinavian people, the people across Europe, the people
in
America.
Well, in France, too, Steve, the extreme right nationalists who are opposed to austerity programs and dictates by bureaucrats in Brussels capitalized on the failure of the left to present a viable alternative. And I think if the left fails, the right is growing as an alternative to failed liberalism.
Yeah, it's true, Jim. The left is more a rhetorical left than an action left. I mean, they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And it certainly has been the case in Greece throughout the years of absolute economic turmoil. The supposed parties of the left, parties of the people, they simply did not come to the defense of the people and stand up forcefully for the principles they claim to believe in. And so if it was the case there, I think it's exactly the same thing in other Western countries. So the people really get cheated so badly. And in my lifetime, it's never been worse than now.
Well, that's true, Steve. On the other hand, we have to think in these terms that people are not giving up because they can't afford to.
Oh, I certainly hope not.
The question of necessity is the mother of struggle, I think, is very much true in the United States as elsewhere. It's only that here there's so much distracting people and there's so much fear, especially at the workplace. We've interviewed people here and part of a action group, and the biggest problem we have is fear that people have, fear of losing their job, fear of not getting a promotion, fear of losing their health plans. And there's no actual support for the corporate elite or for the political elite. It's fear. And people will hesitate even to talk to you in private about their grievances at the workplace because they say, if my boss hears about this, so when you want to write up a story and you ask people, they say, please don't use my name. Or others say, well, listen, I'd talk to you, but I'm afraid someone might find out. So it's like a police state that permeates the consciousness of people, but I think that consciousness reflects a certain reality. There's total intolerance of any dissent today in the American workplace.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. They're afraid they're going to get fired. Just like in Israel, anybody who expresses support for Palestinians, the hammer of the Israeli state will come down on them in many ways. So it's the same thing in America, same thing in Europe. People are scared, and they simply don't back up their principles with action. It really is a shame. We had it back in the 1960s, early 1970s. If there was some way to revive that, one important thing missing now is leadership. I don't see any leadership to get people aroused enough to want to do something in their own defense to protect their own welfare. We need a Martin Luther King around today. We don't have it.
Well, yes, there are some small signs. The city councilwoman, socialist elected in Seattle. We see some green candidates that are getting elected in Colorado and some of the other places. There is dissent on a vast scale. It's a question of linking the individual discontent with public commitment.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. We're out of time.
It's been good talking to you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jim. I look forward to having you back. I'll get back, and we'll get you back on and continue this discussion.
All right,
the big problems aren't going away. We know that.
Right. Bye.
Thank you, Jim.